This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and 1 year ago today, Massachusetts confirmed its first case of COVID-19 in a UMass Boston student recently returned from China. Now, that day, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health assured residents that, quote, the risk to the public from the 2019 novel coronavirus remains low in Massachusetts, end quote. Well, we want to spend the day today reflecting on that 1 year anniversary, and I was thinking about it this morning. 2 days after that first diagnosis, I got tested for the flu, which it turned out I had. And I remember before entering my room at the urgent care clinic where I went to get the test, the medical professional stopped at the door and asked me, "Have you recently been to China?" He came through the door after I said no, because at the time we were both assuming that that was all the screening we needed to ensure I wasn't carrying COVID-19, despite the fact that I had fever, fatigue, a cough. Well, what a difference a year makes. So today we have several members of Boston's medical community looking back on the year with us, mostly professionals we talked to early on. And we begin with two guests who we spoke with on April 7th, 2020. Now, that was our first Radio Boston conversation about early signs that the coronavirus was having disproportionate impact on vulnerable populations and communities of color. Joining us are Dr. Joseph Betancourt, the Vice President and Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer of Massachusetts General Hospital, and Michael Curry, who is CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the state's COVID-19 Vaccine Advisory Group. Dr. Betancourt, Michael, welcome back to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So you heard me talk a little bit about what was on my mind this morning, thinking back a year to that first diagnosis in Massachusetts. Let me ask you the same things. Dr. Betancourt, what's on your mind on this 1 year anniversary?
Well, you know, it's interesting just to reflect on the fact that it was April 7th last year. Boy, what a difference a year makes, where the time goes. And I think as I just reflect back on that conversation, I would say that we predicted pretty much exactly what was going to happen. I recall talking about even then with Michael how communities of color were at highest risk. And here we are. It wasn't just locally, but it was nationally. And communities of color were hit hard. They were hit early. And they've been, you know, really devastated by this economically and otherwise, health-wise, and not just here in Boston, but around the country. And so I think it's been a real journey. It's been difficult. It's been challenging. It's been there's been a sense of urgency throughout. And we're nowhere near done. And even when we're done with COVID, the battle for equity continues. So those are just, I think we're focused a lot on the vaccine now, but those are just some reflections from our last conversation to now.
Michael, how about your reflections?
Yeah, I would agree with Dr. Betancourt. The past is prologue is always stuck in my mind, and that people like Dr. Betancourt and many other folks who do emergency preparedness have been warning us for such a day, right? We wish we should have been prepared this time last year, because we knew a pandemic was not a possibility, it was an inevitability. And people had warned us about how many would die. They had warned us about how overrun our emergency rooms would be, or the lack of PPE. All these things have been discussed. And I tell people, the most troubling hearing I've ever participated in my adult life of doing government relations work was a hearing at the State House, which I wouldn't be surprised if Dr. Betancourt was part of the panels, that really foreshadowed what would happen when we had our next pandemic. And it was terrifying. And then I think back to a year ago, that if we had just listened to the scientists, to the experts, how many more lives would we have saved? How much more PPE would we have had on hand? And how much better prepared overall we could have been? So that's what I think about, Tiziana, when I think back over the last year.
Are you angry, Michael?
No, not angry. I think I get disappointed in us, right? It's because whether it's, Tiziana, as you and I have talked about the racial justice stuff that we're going through at the same time, that other pandemic, these warnings, people have been warning us of this stuff, have been trying to get our attention and pay attention. It's funny, Dr. Betancourt, I put on my social media page the other day, which applies to this pandemic as well. I said, I'm so glad that so many people are woke and others are waking up, but some of us are insomniacs. And the reality is, Dr. Betancourt's been an insomniac on this stuff of health equity and what this would mean. Too bad we didn't pay attention.
So Dr. Betancourt, I mean, what Michael just said, that insomniac concept, that's never going to leave me, you know, not at the end of this pandemic, not in getting ready for the next one. Was there a moment, was there a sleepless night for you early on, Dr. Betancourt? Now I'm being literal with his metaphor there, where you sort of realized, oh, we have this wrong and this is going to be really, really bad, especially for vulnerable people.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, he too is an insomniac, and there's a lot of us who've been committed to this issue for a long time who really understand the urgency of this as it was evolving. You know, not to mention that, just to bring it into the mix, the murder of George Floyd, kind of as we were coming off our surge, to kind of further add kind of insult to injury and further kind of highlight all the issues that we've been talking about. And so it really just, I think everything was so magnified. I think for me, there was a couple of key moments. Early on, certainly, you know, very, very early on, I mean, getting the dispatches from Italy, just from a general standpoint, as we were seeing healthcare professionals over there describe what was happening. That's when it hit me. I said, you know, this isn't, you know, these aren't dispatches from a third world or unknown country. I was able to see very visually what was happening. And that's when I literally got on, you know, text and email to friends to say, hey, you know, this is real. We need to, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. I think the second was, you know, not shortly after our conversation, as we saw how this was growing, we understood that our ability to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 wasn't about you know, ICU capacity or beds. This is really about what we were able to do at people's doorstep in the community. And, you know, people like Michael and others have been working around community health for all this, you know, for decades, for forever. And we've been talking about the importance of community health. And I think this pandemic really illustrated fundamentally that public health, community health is essential. Those kind of, you know, upstream interventions prevent the downstream impacts of being overwhelmed inside our hospitals. And there was a lot of sleepless nights around how are we going to mobilize quickly to, you know, put this fire out or slow its spread in communities, in these hotspot communities. And I guess the last, you know, what's created a lot of sleepless nights for me as a caregiver is having, you know, served on the surge teams is just seeing people suffer and seeing people die alone and seeing, you know, the pain. It's real. And I think it's been that much more difficult as this has been, you know, over the year politicized and called a hoax. And, you know, I often tell people, I just wish I could download a little bit of my memory and what I've seen to you so you could understand this as we kind of heard these you know, kind of rumors running rampant.
So before I turn back to Michael, let me see if I can actually help you download a little of your memory. Is there a particular patient or a particular case that is staying with you that you could share with us?
Yeah, you know, we stood up an effort here at Mass General, which I'm very proud of, right? So very quickly we realized as we were tracking our COVID positive patients early on, that up to 30 to 40% were Spanish speaking, outstripping the supply of our interpreters who could no longer be with us live. And because we were trying to preserve PPE, we're virtual. And so we stood up something called the Spanish Language Care Group. We did a call to action. 50 native Spanish speaking doctors basically agreed to cover the hospital 24/7, 7 during the day, 4 at night, really kind of providing and making sure that there was clinical, cultural, and linguistic competence, and a Spanish-speaking doctor at every instance. And I think for me, you know, there was a patient that I remember seeing, and it's kind of cuts both ways. It's the joy and the pain. The joy of walking into that room and having that patient hear me speak Spanish and just his face light up to understand, wow, there's a Spanish-speaking doctor here, because we are, you know, doctors of color are few and far between, but to have that and to know that we are here to serve you, you know, to see his joy, but then quickly to see his pain as we were kind of working with him to prevent him from getting intubated and kind of coaching him to try to kind of lie on his stomach, and that was difficult for him because he had a pacemaker. I mean, you know, it brought so many things to mind. You know, I could communicate in his language, but it really was a team of people doing everything they could to care for him. You know, the pain he was under and how tenuous he was. And it was, you know, shortly thereafter where, you know, he started to take a turn. But those memories, I think, stick with you for a lifetime, and they're things that we won't forget, and they drive us. They drive us to try to grab as much ground as we can right now during this time and to not have a short memory and to have a courage to not have a short memory about what we've all experienced to make a better healthcare system and better and deeper investments in community health and public health.
Thank you for sharing that story, actually. You know, it really does help it come home for those of us who have not been on the front lines and haven't seen what you've seen. Michael, a minute ago, you expressed some frustration that there was testimony, there was information we had before this pandemic struck that had we listened and paid attention, we could have done differently. And it makes me think about the moment we're in now, where we are now hearing about inequitable access to vaccines, whether that's where the centers are being stood up or the pace at which it's rolling out. You know, I know you were on the advisory group. You are on the governor's COVID vaccine advisory group. When did that planning start in earnest? And, you know, were people listening about equity and access issues from the beginning in that planning?
Yeah, I think, you know, first and foremost, credit to the governor for he and his many colleagues across the country put together these working groups, I think at the advice of the CDC, and chose an excellent leader in Paul Bettinger to lead it. Paul, from day one, maybe 6-7 months ago, we started meeting and discussing a prioritization strategy. Paul's always been receptive to the issue of equity. So you have folks like myself on that task force, both in the role that I have here at the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, but in my racial justice work. You have Liz Walker, who's been a champion right there in Roxbury for the patients and the communities and the folks who are attendees of her church. You have Dr. McLean at MGH and many others, even our new head of the CDC, Ms. Walensky, Dr. Walensky, was part of this effort. Everyone embraced the notion of equity. Now, you know, part of the challenge when you have a group is to figure out what equity looks like, right? How do you prioritize groups? Who goes up? In what order? And that was really the work of that group. I never, not at any point, felt that there wasn't a shared commitment to equity. But the challenge, again, is to figure out how to do it. So I say that to say, Tiziana, the process was good. Where we often fall down in the work of equity is in the implementation. And we're seeing that across the country. Here in Massachusetts, we prioritize some groups. One, healthcare workers like Dr. Betancourt and the others that are on the front line, because we know we need them to be here, available, healthy, to respond to this pandemic for the months to come, including our many community health center leaders, our long-term care providers, our homeless shelter leaders and their patients, the participants, and many other areas that need to be on the front lines. And then when you get to phase two, which we started today, that older population, which are dying at a disparate rate, they're higher, older Americans that are sick and dying. Where the equity falls apart is that we don't identify some of the challenges with age populations. So 75 and older, though we're starting there today, is a little bit more weighted to white communities because of life expectancy. So one of the things we tried to get to quickly in our process was comorbidities and younger age groups, 60, 65 and older, to offset the age groups that are predominantly white. Those are the kind of discussions and challenges and nuances that we had to get into in the task force. And I'm just hoping that on the implementation side, we can do better as we roll out this vaccine. If we do not, we will see this disease born differently on Black and Brown folks than it will on white Massachusetts residents or white Bostonians.
So I was struck by that list you just gave, Michael. Everybody but Wanda McLean are people we've spoken with in the last several months about this this pandemic and about vaccinations. And that, you know, Boston is the heartbeat of a lot of medical advancement. We're going to talk with Dr. Dan Baruch later, who helped advance the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It makes me think, Dr. Betancourt, so Rochelle Walensky's now at the CDC in Washington. Is the change there and the talent that this new administration has brought going to make a difference for us, a practical difference for us here on the ground in Massachusetts?
Without question. I mean, I think we need to understand that the challenges that we face at the state level really stem from a lack of any viable federal plan. The fact that Rochelle Walensky, who's a friend who I know cares deeply about this work, arrives at the CDC and is unable to even inventory her stockpile of vaccination tells you that there's a big problem. And so when you have states having a lot of uncertainty about, you know, what and when their vaccine supply will be, then from a trickle-down standpoint of how we get needles into arms in how we engage healthcare systems, health centers, community-based organizations to mobilize this effort, you know, that variable is so big that it becomes nearly impossible to plan. So it's no excuses. It's just reality. And, I've been pleased to know that there's no shortage of I think, leaders with great intentions. But, you know, we're playing with a deck of cards that's just very, very challenging right now. And it does require that people have patience. And I know that's probably the hardest thing to do. This pandemic's been going on for a long time. But ultimately, I do believe that with this new leadership, with Dr. Walensky's leadership and the new administration really focused on deployment and leveraging resources and helping the states who are struggling and the states then being able to help us, I think we're up for a much better opportunity to make progress, hopefully in the weeks to come, but certainly in the months to come.
And Tisiana,
all right, and Michael, yep. Yes.
One quick point. I just want to reinforce this. I said this at the governor's press conference, but I want to restate this. Thank God for the advocates. I've been an advocate. Secretary Sutters was an advocate before she joined the administration. Dr. Betancourt has been in that role. People need to ask critical questions and hold everyone accountable because we all need to answer those questions. So if you're asking about equity, don't stop. If you're asking about resourcing and getting doses into communities of color, don't stop. Ask the critical questions and force the rest of us to answer it.
All right. And that is Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Michael, I know you're going to stay with us a little longer in the show. So I also want to thank Dr. Joseph Betancourt, the Vice President and Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer of Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Betancourt, I know we're saying goodbye to you. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for the time. And it's always a pleasure to be on with Michael. So I thank you and wish you all the best.
We are marking the first year anniversary or the 1 year anniversary of the first documented case of COVID-19 here in Massachusetts. But outside, a winter storm system that has dumped over a foot of snow on New York City is making its way over New England. We've got high winds, coastal flooding, heavy snowfall. So we want to just take a quick minute to understand what's unfolding and learn about what's coming next over the next few hours. We've got National Weather Service Boston meteorologist Christy Smith with us. Christy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Christy, where is the worst of this storm right now, and what can Greater Boston expect overall?
So, for New England, the worst of this storm is actually kind of in or over southern Connecticut and working its way up through Hartford and northeastern Connecticut, as well as coastal Rhode Island. However, these heavy bands that we're seeing of potentially 1 to 2 inches per hour of snow are moving up through Massachusetts now and should be approaching Boston within the next few hours. Just looking out the window at our office here in Norton, I can tell you that in the last half hour or so, we've gone from pretty much no snow on the ground to a pretty generous coating of snow. So the accumulation should happen very quickly, and it should start in Boston in the next few hours.
And how much do you think we're going to get, Christy, at this point?
So for Boston, we're looking at about 8 inches, but there is a coastal front setting up for us here in southeastern Massachusetts that's likely to affect the city of Boston. That just means that warm temperatures are kind of prohibiting snowfall in coastal locations. So between perhaps Logan Airport and the western suburbs of Boston, Brookline, Brighton areas there, we could see a pretty significant difference in the amount of snow. So you could have up to a foot of snow out in Metro West and then perhaps just a few inches east at the airport.
And there are some who have to commute. So what can you tell us about conditions of the roadways now, the next couple of hours? How's visibility?
Sure. So visibilities will be reduced, potentially up or down to a quarter of a mile. So conditions will be pretty treacherous for driving this evening. We are expecting conditions to deteriorate very quickly as these heavier snow bands push in and more snow accumulates on the ground. So we're hopeful that people who have to be out take it very slow and are cautious driving home, but certainly recommend if you don't have to be out, you probably just want to stay home.
And Christy, the peak hours for this storm, and then when should it significantly taper off?
So we're actually heading into the peak now. We're thinking that we'll see most of the accumulation for much of Massachusetts to occur between just about this hour and midnight tonight. And then after midnight, we'll see snow tapering off and moving off to our north and east. And then by tomorrow morning, we may just have some flurries and rain showers actually mixing in, especially for Boston. But we won't see much accumulation, especially compared to what we're going to experience this evening.
Okay, and briefly, Christy, I know it's a dicey game to look more than 7 days out, but it's February, and we all still remember 2015. So are we entering a nasty time here? What's coming?
So certainly people do have PTSD when they hear the words 2015 sometimes, but unfortunately here at the office, we do focus on the next 3 to 7 days. But right now, we don't have any major storms in our forecast. We're actually looking at later this week, a relative warm-up, especially compared to the frigid temperatures we saw this past weekend, with temperatures into the upper 30s and perhaps even low 40s for Boston and points south and east. So in terms of the rest of February, we are going to keep an eye out on it and update people as storms approach.
All right. That is National Weather Service Boston meteorologist Christy Smith. Christy, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we started the hour with Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the state's COVID-19 Vaccine Advisory Group. Michael, you're still with us, yes?
I am.
Great. So in a minute, we're going to talk to two healthcare workers with whom we spoke last spring about what it's like to be on the front lines fighting the pandemic. Before we talk to them, I want to ask you, this time last year and in the ensuing months, really, you know, February, March, April, what were you hearing from staff and community health centers in our area?
Yeah, they were in turmoil, right? They were, like the hospitals, dealing with precipitous declines in revenue as they were health centers were not seeing patients coming into sites. We hadn't fully adopted telehealth, meaning we, society, hadn't fully adopted telehealth. In fact, there were many people like Mass League of Community Health Centers and the Mass Hospital Association and others trying to urge us to move forward. I use the term quantum leap. We needed to leap forward to adopt this technology, and the pandemic was forcing us to do it on a dime. But in the interim, precipitous declines in revenue, potential closures, dealing with the response to the patients that were now getting ill and getting them the care and directing them either to treatment or getting them into the emergency rooms was really driving many of our healthcare professionals to the brink in this crisis. And then we were really responding to the many needs of local public health departments that needed us to not only treat our patients, but to be part of the DCU Center or the Convention Center here in Boston or the nursing homes and the other settings where folks didn't have any infrastructure to respond to the testing and the contact tracing. There's a lot that's happened, Tiziana, over last year. I do say, with Dr. Betancourt no longer with us on the call, but to all you providers, you nurses, you doctors at community health centers, at the hospitals and in other settings, that image that my son brought into my room of all of the superheroes lining the hallway and then the providers walking down the hallway and they're all bowing to them and applauding, that's real. That we never probably took the time to just pause and appreciate that we're asking them to even risk their lives during this pandemic. And I don't want to lose sight of that, particularly for the 52 health centers across the state serving over 1 million patients and those healthcare workers that are also on the front line.
Well, Michael, that sets us up perfectly for this next conversation. I'm going to ask you to stand by while we turn to two of those heroes. We talked with two particular healthcare providers last spring that stuck in our mind as we were preparing for today. One became a reflection in April from Dr. Benjamin Linus, who is an infectious disease physician. He reflected after working a 72-hour shift that he called the hardest thing he had ever done in medicine.
It's hard at a lot of levels. The obvious that the volume is very high and it's just a lot of work. But beyond, it's also just like how much COVID there is. And usually on a regular day of work, I go around, I look at infections, I see different things. And this is just, COVID case after COVID case.
And we also heard then from Marlena Pellegrino, a nurse at St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester. She told us back in May what it felt like walking into the hospital every day at the height of the first wave.
You're entering a very unknown situation. It's like a war zone. You don't know what you're going to be hit with at any given moment. Things can change. They evolve very quickly, minute to minute, hour to hour. You don't have the proper tools that you need. Sometimes you don't have the exact support that you need, but you have one another.
So Dr. Linus and Nurse Pellegrino, they've joined us again now. And just quickly again, Dr. Linus is an infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Boston University School of Medicine. And Nurse Marlena Pellegrino is a frontline medical surgical nurse at St. Vincent Hospital and co-chair of the nurses' local bargaining unit with the Massachusetts Nurses Association at her hospital. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here.
So it's a year later, Dr. Linus, is that what's on your mind? Do you have the ability to reflect to a year ago, or are you still just taking it day to day?
Perhaps a little bit of both. I think we're all taking it somewhat day to day these days, but I think it's important to look up and reflect at important anniversaries like this. And it has been quite a year. We've come so far. I think we're still deep in this pandemic, and all of us wish that we were not. But I also think a lot has changed. And I was thinking back and hearing my voice from a year ago and reflecting on what is different now. And we really have, you know, back then, it just hearing those words reminded me of just the overwhelming volume that we were seeing and this perfect storm of work and volume. We didn't really have any effective therapies at that point. There was so much uncertainty about what this disease was and what it was not. And that led to a lot of fear, both for our patients and also for ourselves. And, you know, when I think back to that, it's pretty traumatic. And today, things are still upsetting, but I do feel like we've come far in the hospital, and we're continuing to work hard, and everyone sees the data that there's still a lot of people coming to the hospital with COVID. But we have a little bit less uncertainty, and we do have effective treatments now, and there's certainly less fear and a little bit less chaos. And those things really make all the difference. And so we're continuing to work hard, but I think we've made a lot of progress, and if we keep on going on this path, we'll get there eventually.
And how about you, Nurse Marlena Pellegrino? Does it feel less chaotic? I mean, I'm struck by the phrase war zone. You felt like you were in a war zone then.
Yes, we did. And it seems like we had a little bit of a lull there towards the summer, but with the second surge, right now it feels like we, at least from my experience in my hospital and from nurses I've talked to, we've been a little bit less prepared for this second surge than we thought we would. We learned a lot, but we have a lot less staffing at the bedside during this surge. It's still a roller coaster and very grueling. We do know what we need to do. It's just that we don't have the exact support in the staff at the bedside. We're doing the best we can, but it's been... it's an honor to go into work, and it feels like it's the place you want to be. And it doesn't feel like a year went by, but also it's still a scary prospect entering the hospital and not knowing if you're going to have enough nurses or just ancillary staff at the bedside to meet your patient's needs. And the patients remain acutely ill. You still see people, you know, to remind people who are not on the inside of the hospital, the COVID patients, how isolated they are behind closed doors, lonely, afraid, some are confused, needing extra care, extra hands, extra touch. And we're not able to get in those rooms fast enough that from a nurse's perspective, that's very difficult. But, you know, we're staying hopeful, of course, and nurses do. But it's been very traumatizing to continue to work this way, and we're looking for improvements, hopefully coming soon. But we've sounded the alarm, and you know, we're hoping that our hospital corporation and other health corporations across the country are taking the concerns and the questions and the advice and the expertise of nurses seriously.
And I know that your nurses association is in negotiations now with St. Vincent Hospital, and I know that staffing has been a part of that picture. Dr. Linus, I want to turn back to you. It was encouraging. That's a tough picture that Marlena was just painting. She also did say she's staying hopeful. Are you feeling hopeful after a year of this? Even though probably last spring, none of us thought, I don't think we really thought we'd still be here in February 2021.
No, certainly not. I was laughing with a friend or reminiscing with a colleague that at the beginning of a research project, we were starting at some point in March or very early April. And someone was saying, well, but right, is this really going to be worth doing? Because if this is over in, say, 3 to 6 weeks of isolation, like, what's the message from this project for the next time, right? And in hindsight, it just seems so silly and naive. I am hopeful. I think it's hard to be all sunshine and these days. And there's a lot of challenges out ahead of us still. But I also have been amazed over the course of this by a few things, including some of the ingenuity of science. And I really do think that, for example, the invention of the vaccine, though not a panacea, and it's not just going to end this the way that we wish that it would, it is one of the shining scientific achievements of humanity, I would argue. And I remember going for my first dose of vaccine, feeling somewhat overwhelmed by that and seeing the people and recognizing what an incredible achievement of discovery in science this really was. And it does give us hope. And I think that I've also been inspired by the fact that it's been dicey at times, and COVID has really wrenched a lot of tears in the fabric of our society. But it's also brought us together in a lot of ways. And there are some silver linings of people working together to try to overcome hardship. And I think if we can grab onto those memories and those role models and keep on persevering, we do have a vaccine now. We are beginning to have effective treatments. And I don't think anyone knows exactly how this looks in the end game, but I think it's possible to start imagining an end game now. And that's new for us, right? It was difficult to imagine even the end game back in the fall.
Marlena, thinking about that end game, I know this may sound like a silly question, but when the day comes when you can pick your head up again and not think about this all the time and be past it a little, what do you most look forward to then?
I look forward to going into work as I normally do, but I look forward to the day when, like yesterday when I was at work, just one example, we had a COVID patient on our floor, which I don't work on a particular COVID unit. We have COVID patients mixed in on my unit. And this certain patient is elderly, and he's been in isolation alone, you know, and confused, and English is the second language. And he's been that way for 14 days. And yesterday when I went in, he was finally taken off his COVID isolation precautions, which means that we could walk into the room as we normally do, you know, walk through a door that's not open without our PPE on, without our mask, our shield. It looks like a full hazmat suit. When actually I went in and I touched his hand, you know, without a glove on, I looked into his eyes, we talked, even though, you know, he might have not understood. I could see that he understood, you know, that he could look in my eyes and I could look in his. And that happened right at the beginning of my shift. And all of my coworkers who have been taking care of this patient, all of us have had a turn at taking care of him. We were able to go in and just be with him and just talk to him and laugh. He could see our faces without the mask on. And I think nurses, we just say, isn't it a relief to just be able to walk into our patient's room at any time they need us, without taking 5 or 6 minutes to put all of our PPE on, without worrying that our other patients aren't going to be seen, because we can at least come out of the room quickly. And, you know, it's the simple things of being able to just walk through a doorway and actually see your patient.
I got to tell you
that it just hit me that, I mean, there's a lot of things, but that just hit me. I was able to talk with this man and, you know, and touch him and see him. And he saw me.
Marlena, that's the vision, right? That really sits home. And that is Marlena Pellegrino. She's a frontline medical surgical nurse at St. Vincent Hospital, also co-chair of the nurses' local bargaining unit with the Massachusetts Nurses Association at St. Vincent's. Also, we've just heard from Dr. Benjamin Linus, who's an infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Boston University School of Medicine. Hey, thank you both for everything you've done in the last year and for spending time with us as we all reflect on this year together.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I'm going to turn back now to you, Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. We have just a couple minutes here, and I got a couple things I want to talk to you about. So briefly, a reflection on what we just heard from Dr. Linus and Nurse Pellegrino.
I think, you know, I couldn't help but go back to my spiritual side, and I thought to myself, but for the grace of God go I. As I think about the work that they both do, about the patients they've seen, about the lives that have been lost, it struck me as I listened to both of them, the challenge that we still have ahead of us. But, you know, we have a different world. when you have to prepare to go into a room to provide care. And we'll be here for a while. And we'll be here again. Even if we get through this pandemic, we'll be here again with the next pandemic. So, you know, I'm just extremely thankful, one, to have my immediate family being healthy. But I realize and recognize that that can go and be taken away at any moment. I just think all of us should take pause, listen to the doctor and the nurse, and think about how fortunate we are. And for those who, as our new president, President Biden says, there's an empty chair in our homes, in many of our homes right now. And there are people that are mourning and have a loss. And I pray for them as well.
And in our last minute, before we say goodbye to you and go to a break, after the break, we're going to talk with Dr. Dan Baruch, the director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel. They were the design lab for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which, if approved for emergency use, it would be single dose. It wouldn't require the specialty freezing that the two current vaccines do. How much of a difference could that make? How much of a game changer could it be for low-income populations, populations of color, neighborhood health centers to get that vaccine out there?
Tiziana, it would be a huge game changer as many providers, particularly in rural areas and urban areas, are not getting access to this vaccine as quickly as we need to get it out. So I think Johnson & Johnson provides a great opportunity for us, but I would caution Tiziana, and I think this is a conversation to happen over the next few months. There's an equity challenge too to Pfizer, which is 95% effective, Moderna, which is 94.5 or whatever that number is, and then Johnson & Johnson being less effective, but effective in the range that typically vaccines are. But we have to be cautious about where we put vaccines that are most effective. And I don't want to relegate poor communities or rural communities to the Johnson & Johnson. We need to find a way to get Pfizer and Moderna to those same communities, to those same patients, to those same arms, and not be stuck with just one vaccine.
All right. Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Thanks for reflecting with us today.
Thank you.
Almost from the beginning, the race against slowing the spread of the virus included a race to develop a vaccine. It is the only way forward to some new semblance of normal in our lives. So we turn now to someone who jumped into that vaccine race very early on. Dr. Dan Baruch is the director for the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. His lab helped design a vaccine for Johnson & Johnson, which, if approved for emergency use, would be the third such vaccine available in the United States. Dr. Baruch, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So my understanding, doctor, is that this work on the vaccine came almost as soon as you knew about the virus. When did you say, oh, there is something going on here and we're going to need to fight it and start that work?
We started working on this vaccine on January 10th of last year, so just over a year ago. And I remember on that day, we were seeing the news reports coming out of Wuhan, China, and there were a cluster of 41 cases of this mysterious pneumonia and one death. And we found those numbers to be alarming. So just think, in a year, we've gone from 41 cases to over 100 million cases and one death to over 2 million deaths and rapidly rising every day. So it's truly astonishing how a virus can essentially rip through society and change everything we know about the world.
It is astonishing. Those numbers are, as is the idea that 3 weeks before the first case was even diagnosed in Massachusetts, and when our public health community was still saying, you don't have to, you know, it's okay. We don't have to be worried here in the Commonwealth. You were already thinking we've got to get a vaccine out there. How fast did you work? How hard did you work? How did you keep the urgency together? You know, take us back there a little bit.
So on January 10th, we reasoned that we probably would need a vaccine for this pandemic. Although it wasn't a pandemic then, we thought that a vaccine might be needed because there were several worrisome features. It was already identified that the virus was a coronavirus. We knew it was a respiratory virus that had never been seen before. which means that humans would not have any immunity to it. So a respiratory virus that could be transmitted person to person with no immunity in the population is the recipe for a pandemic. Also, we were very concerned from a pandemic perspective that the severity of illness was actually relatively mild. And you might say that that's a good thing. And of course, it's a
right.
good thing. For SARS, it was a much more severe illness where everyone had a fever, everyone got really sick. And so it was easy to isolate and quarantine. Here, we were faced with a new pathogen that was much more mild. A lot of people only get mildly sick. A lot of people don't get sick at all, but still can transmit the virus as asymptomatic carriers. So we thought it would be much more difficult to control this virus by traditional public health measures. Now, of course, on January 10th of last year, we had no idea that it would do what it did. But we were concerned enough that we started vaccine efforts essentially immediately. And that was the day that the Chinese researchers released the sequence of the virus and basically started much of the world's global vaccine efforts.
And just for our listeners' sake, SARS was another coronavirus, which I'm not sure if you mentioned that earlier. All right, so we are now less than 13 months later. Here we are, Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that was your partner, the production partner, is coming up soon for approval for emergency use in the United States. I know you were listening before the break. You heard us talking with Michael Curry, the CEO of the League of Community Health Centers. He raised a couple of things there. I'm sure you're aware that part of the public conversation among lay people is this difference in efficacy, reported efficacy between the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And I'm sure you heard Michael say that if that's a more accessible vaccine and therefore it goes to community of colors, you could have a new equity challenge in different levels of efficacy. How do you address that, and how can you explain to a layperson this question of difference in efficacy and how that really plays out?
Well, the clinical trials were done differently. So they were not head-to-head clinical trials. And the phase 3 study with J&J was conducted in multiple regions of the world, including multiple regions of the developing world, such as Sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America. It's a different pandemic now than it was a few months ago. So any vaccine tested now would have far lower efficacy than a vaccine tested last fall.
Because of the new variants?
There were no resistant variants. Now we have a much more complicated pandemic. We have a much more complex pandemic where there are partially resistant variants in essentially all areas of the world, including in the United States, particularly in California. And a substantial fraction of the viruses in Brazil, and over 95% of the viruses in South Africa are a particularly worrisome partially resistant variant. And we know that all of those variants are already present in the United States. So it's a very different pandemic now, and it's really not possible to compare efficacy of vaccines tested last fall with vaccines that are tested for efficacy now.
And how is the efficacy of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine affected by these variants?
Substantially. And we think that probably all vaccines will have substantially reduced efficacy against these variants. We saw last week data from two companies, Novavax and J&J, both of which showed a substantial reduction of efficacy against the South Africa or the variant that's coming from South Africa. But overall, the most important efficacy for the J&J vaccine is the demonstration of 85% efficacy against severe disease and 100% efficacy against hospitalizations and death. And that includes clinical protection against the variants. So I think that it's actually probably the first vaccine study that shows high-grade clinical protection against the entire population of worldwide viruses, including the most worrisome variants.
So I just want to put that in lay terms. So are you saying that in the last phase of the trial, there were zero people who were hospitalized or died from any of the virus variants when inoculated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
Yes. So in the trial, there were no hospitalizations or deaths in vaccine recipients.
Okay, so this picture that you're painting, it's I think for all of us, because we're living in it, we're not just reporting on it, we're not just talking about it, we're all living in it. It's this roller coaster where one minute in the middle of the night, I'm like hopeful because I hear those numbers and we've got a vaccine that has been trialed during the variants that have been scaring us. And in another minute, we hear about slow rollouts and, you know, efficacy that is still not at 100%, which is, of course, everyone's dream. In the middle of the night, are you waking up? Or is this a time when you're sleeping well because 13 months of work has led to a vaccine? Where are you in the complexity of this moment?
The efficacy results last week were very, very good. We were very happy with it. To demonstrate high-grade efficacy against severe disease, hospitalizations, and death, which is really what we were trying to avoid, not just in the United States, but in Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa. That's really what we want in a vaccine. But there's a lot of work to do. So I think that this vaccine will likely be part of the armamentarium of interventions. And we hope it'll have a major impact, both in the United States and throughout the world. But there is a tremendous amount of work that remains to be done. First, we have to understand more about these viral variants. We need to vaccinate people more quickly. We have to roll out these vaccines more quickly, because now the purpose of vaccination is not only to protect the individual and protect society, but also the faster we can vaccinate the population, the more likely we can prevent the emergence of the next variants for next week and next month and 3 months from now. Because we know that there will likely be more of these variants that emerge, and they could potentially be even more troublesome than the ones we have today.
So you think there are more coming?
It's very important to roll out the vaccines even more quickly than before, because we want to try to prevent the emergence of variants that could undermine the entire global vaccine effort.
So are you today, are you exhausted or are you exhilarated?
I think I've been exhausted and exhilarated every day for the past year, simultaneously.
And what's exhausting and what's exhilarating?
Well, I think that we have the biggest global health challenge of our times sitting right in front of our eyes right now. And we also have the opportunities to intervene and the opportunities to actually try to end this pandemic is what's exhilarating, and the gravity and the monumental task ahead of us is what's exhausting.
You've been working on vaccines for other pernicious illnesses. Is this the accomplishment of your career, or is there more coming next?
Well, you know, I think I've been so busy, I haven't really had much chance to reflect on things from a perspective like that. But I guess we're very happy with how things have gone. There's going to be a lot more data coming out from this study, and we will look forward to the review by the FDA. And if they approve it, we'll see how it rolls out into the populations. And hopefully it has a major clinical impact, both in our country and throughout the world.
Well, I hope as your days go forward, there's more exhilaration than exhaustion. That's Dr. Dan Baruch, Director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Dr. Baruch, thanks. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that is our reflection for today on the one-year anniversary of the first diagnosis of the coronavirus in Massachusetts. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, and with some help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Tesh Hathi is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. This is Radio Boston.